Welcome, in case you're in the wrong room, this is DNS. This is not light switch, light box. This isn't virtualization. This is DNS. This is core infrastructure. This is where you get your inner geek on port number 53. And my name is Rick Claus. I have a Canadian accent, in case you haven't figured that out, about and about and that sort of stuff. I'm a senior technical evangelist up in Canada, and I've been doing some presentations down at Tech Ed, and I know Jeff Alexander, or Jeffa36 as he's known on Twitter. In case you're wondering, my handle up there is RicksterCDN, and this session is SRV305, in case you wanted to tweet some stuff up there. It's my first time in Australia, first time in this hemisphere altogether, and it's interesting. A friend of mine, just Pete, one of the MCTs here, just introduced me to Vegemite, Tam Tams, ginger beer, and that square that's got coconut and chocolate on it, lemon tins and stuff like that. So I've been well indoctrinated to all the different things. Up in Canada, what we get you to do if you visit us up there, I'm from the East Coast, close to Newfoundland, is we'd make you go into the harbor and jig a cod. Once you've jigged that cod and you hauled it in, you know what a cod is? Codfish? Big, ugly fish, great meat on it. But then we make you kiss it, and then you have to take a shot of really bad rum. And I think I found that same rum here last night, and it's called Benny's? No. Bundy's. A bunny. Bundy. I had a bunny and Coke last night, and not very good. Anyway. Some other things I found very interesting happening when I came down this neck of the woods. I spoke at Tech Ed Auckland in New Zealand just before coming over here. And I noticed that there are some definite similarities that we happen to have as a culture, as Commonwealth countries, which is very, very nice. It makes me feel comfortable presenting here and working here. So typically this is what people would see about Canada with the Mountie, the Beaver, and the hockey player and that sort of stuff. But we have a couple shared passions. One of them happens to be really good-looking money. Australians have amazing money. Canadians also have amazing money. However, your money's cooler because it can get wet, go through the washing machine, and then not get torn. Up in Canada, it just disintegrates because it doesn't get that wet when it's in snow. But here, it's very, very cool. I saw a whole documentary on how that money was made. Very, very neat. But then also, we have something else. We have a national religion. It's called hockey in Canada. And the national religion here in Australia and also in New Zealand is obviously rugby. That's the wrong one. Rugby, there we go. That's the right one. I had a chance to take in a match. I saw a union game on Saturday where the Wallabies beat the All Blacks. And, you know, that was good. I was very happy. But I went to Auckland first, and so I actually... I had one of these, and then after the All Blacks went down, congratulations, by the way, I decided I needed to change it up, so. Now, I still have to wear official speaker shirts, and so I took the purple shirt and I cut it, and I made a patch on the back to be able to continue to talk. Now, someone told me after I spoke in New Zealand, says, what are you doing, Rick? You're so Canadian, you got a Canadian flag when you talk. You give away maple syrup. Yes, I give away maple syrup to good questions in here. They said, how come you're not supporting Canada? Like, they were just down here playing a game for the, getting ready for the World Cup, and apparently they played Australia. Of course, you guys trounced us. So, you know, there's the rankings. There's Canada. We're not last. We're 14th. Out of the countries. And of course, there's Australia up at the top, number two. Almost number one, but number two. At least you're going in with the Tri-Nations Cup and you're going in good. The one thing we also have in common besides good money and a passion for sport, we're both beating the United States, which is 18th in rugby, which is very important. But then I decided, hey, let's quickly take a look and see what the stats are, because, you know, this rugby team might be actually doing pretty good for Canadians. I don't know what we're called. You know, we're not the Wallabies. We're not the All Blacks. We're something. So I took a look at New Zealand's record, and obviously they completely pummeled us for points for the last matches they ever met us at. And then I looked at Australians, and I got to say, at least you guys are very nice. You didn't beat us as bad as the All Blacks beat us. You let us get a little bit more points whenever we play you, but for that I say thank you for letting us do that. And I said, you know, wouldn't this be neat to have kind of a mashup of having Canadian ice hockey and ice with rugby? And someone said, well, they do that right now. And I'm like, what? What, do they have some kind of ice hockey rugby league or something like that? It's like, no. You need a lot of ice when you play rugby, apparently, because I couldn't believe the injuries that were coming off the field. You guys don't even stop. You just, the medic runs out and starts fixing people, and the game's still going on. It's freaky. It's awesome. But anyway, besides that, I did a little bit more research on top of that. In fact, there actually is a better matchup coming up soon. Australian does have an ice hockey team, and maybe they'll come and play in Canada someday, and we'll see where we land up. So that's my little piece about Australia. You know what? I think it's time to start. So let's get ahead and get started with this DNS infrastructure. I'm an infrastructure geek. I love all things infrastructure. I've been doing consulting for 20-plus years, designing different systems for companies as small as a mom-and-pop shop all the way up to multiple provincial government organizations with, you know, 50 to 100,000 people, multiple sites. So I've seen the whole range of stuff with regards to Active Directory, with regards to coexistence, and I'm a huge fan of Active Directory. I'm very, very passionate about directories and how they work. Active Directory is completely useless without DNS, right? I mean, DNS finds the objects. You find the object in Active Directory, you then resolve it inside DNS. They go hand in hand. It's like a Tim and a Tam, Tim-Tam, I guess. Active Directory, basically, like humans, need to have DNS to be able to go ahead and to resolve IP addresses to names and names to IP addresses. Otherwise, things just don't work. You know, we're not going to go ahead in the regular internet and have my mother-in-law in Charlottetown go ahead and be able to resolve my website address of 73.127.18.95 to find regularitguy.com. It just doesn't work. So DNS is the way that everything does it. And you're all here, and so obviously you all assume that you know what that happens to mean. So when DNS fails, that's when problems happen. What I don't like about it is that when DNS fails, you don't automatically always know. Just weird stuff starts to happen. You can't resolve things. Maybe it's slow. Things are happening. They're timing out. They're falling back over to a secondary DNS where it's happening to work, because the way DNS works is very hierarchical, so that's all good. But this session's basically going to go through and walk you through with some baby steps first. And then we're going to be going down deeper and then deeper, down to network packet analysis, down to tools analysis for what you can do for DNS. Before we can get down to that level, I got to make sure everyone can get to the same level of common conversation and then get down for simple things like how do queries work, what ports are being used, how are transaction IDs and how are session IDs being used, and all that sort of stuff, firewall rules, to be able to understand troubleshooting. The basic principle of this session is, if you are able to determine what a natural and healthy conversation between a client and a server is using DNS, internal DNS name resolution, dynamic DNS resolution, or external, you know, internet resolution going on with your ISP, if you're able to determine what a normal packet structure looks like, you're then able to tell when an unhealthy packet structure comes back. It's not going to scare you enough to run out of the room to decide, I can't handle this, we're looking at network packets, it's not the way to go. But it's definitely going to at least give you that background to understand when things are unhealthy, what you can do to make things better. So our agenda today really comes down to, okay, how does this thing DNS work? What are these things called recursive queries, and how do I use them? Taking a look at a query in depth with breaking down some different parts to how that works, and then going further and then going further with the use of different protocols, TCP and UDP, how to take a look at it with Network Monitor, and then even further break down the requirements of how the structure of DNS queries have to happen, and then even further down into some extensions and improvements, because DNS has been around for a very long time and really has been serving us quite well up until this point, where things are going to start to really need to change. Finally, some DNS tools. All the stuff is available. You don't have to really take notes. There's a lot of verbose verbatim inside these slides that are there, so you can go and download them after the fact and then take a look at it from there. Are there any questions before we start? This is the last session before lunch, so I'm usually, you're edging to get out of here. The more interactive you are, the faster I go. It's really good. I was very excited when I started here, and I see this connect thing. I'm thinking if I start like trying to move my slides with my hands, it would work, but it doesn't work, unfortunately. And no, I'm not going to do Dance Dance Central for you. That's just wrong for an infrastructure guy. So first off, DNS logs. Again, You have a problem with DNS. Your clients aren't able to resolve and find a server, be it a domain controller, be it a web server, whatever it happens to be. Maybe it's even your one of your relatives in your house or something like that, because we all know how good tech support is. I don't know. What's tech support like down here when you call the cable company and say you got a problem with the internet? Is it good? It's probably like I could play you an MP3 file for a Quebecois in Quebec talking the biggest yuck and slang, swearing one side down the other side of this tech guy. I feel so bad for the guy, all because his cable internet isn't working to be able to resolve names. And it was all because of a DNS configuration error. They found it at the very end. So back to the beginning. Logs is generally your first place you start with anything, right? Throw up your event logs. Inside your event logs, you're going to see a number of different error messages and questions and that sort of stuff you can take a look at. But more specifically, how about these logs? So this is actually a text-based log from my DNS service that I've turned on. By default, DNS logging is turned off, so you have to go in and choose properties of the DNS server and turn on logging, and then you start to get these text-based logs. And we can see here, here's a log entry for a particular query that's going off. Okay, what can I see here? I can see that I've got port number 53, so that's an easy thing. I'm looking for an address that is a directed address, so I know how to get to it. I've got a query, it's not giving me too much right now. Here we go, I got some stuff I can remember. I'm looking for something like bracket 5 and bracket Yahoo, bracket 3 and bracket com, bracket 0. It's like, what am I doing here? I'm doing a query, but it's not great troubleshooting material to jump right in and take a look at from the very, very beginning because of the way the log happens to be formatted. By the end of this, you'll be able to understand this in much more detail to see what exactly it is that we're trying to do to come up with. In this case, we're looking for MX records for yahoo.com from a query, probably from NSLookup, looking for a particular record type. So that's where we're going to be heading, down this individual path. And first up is queries, how queries work, and how recursion works in DNS, and how the DNS infrastructure, where that happens to sit. Very interesting stuff. First off is simply looking back at the background for how a particular query happens. Let's say we got a PC, call it PC1. It's looking up an address of a particular website or a server. In this case, I'm going to step away from talking about specific DNS stuff with Active Directory because we're going to take baby steps first, and simply take a look at ada.bigfirm.com. It's a very simple address, a very simple query. We're going to see exactly how many queries go through and take place to be able to resolve that, and then also what's inside each one of those queries. Because the idea is that, what am I going to do? My client's going to say, booting up, I'm looking for an address, please. DHCP says, okay, I've got one. He's going to say, yeah, I'll take it. And the DHCP service says, okay, here you go. You got it for this long, and here's all the parameters that go with it, right? DHCP conversation, ACKs and ACKs, very, very simple. Part of that information is a hard-coded DNS address. That's part of that DHCP packet that comes down. And DNS address means that my client now knows I don't broadcast to look for stuff. I'm going to do a directed query across the router to get to this server and ask a question. Very simple, right? So you actually have some troubleshooting beforehand in case you got address allocation stuff or in case you got your DNS servers incorrectly put into your systems. But then how does that guy know where bigfirm.com is if I'm not part of bigfirm.com? It's got to be able to find that. Now picture this. Every single person in this room doing that times 100 million people all at the same time. Think of that traffic that's going on. Hopefully he can handle that with that server load for that particular DNS server. But like, where does that all go? It just magically works in the background. So like, it's like you pick up the telephone and you expect to hear a dial tone. That's how DNS should be and how it normally is viewed by our user community, right? So recursion's actually, pretty simple. The whole concept is if the guy doesn't know, that server knows he can go someplace else and ask those questions. And so it uses the public DNS system to be able to do that as an example, and it's able to find out where the top level happens to be. It's no surprise, I'm assuming, top level is called root. Leave it to an IT group to be able to put roots of a tree up at the very top of a hierarchy. Don't ask me why. But that's the root, which is dot. And then at the very top, it basically says, hey, what do you got? The root is able to go in and say, well, you know what? I'm too busy. I don't know the answer. Go talk to these guys, the next level down, which is known as a top-level domain. No surprises to anybody in the room? Good. Top-level domain, pretty simple stuff. That's where you have, .us, .ca, .com, .au, whatever it happens to be, as far as names happen to be. And then the whole point is that this distributed database of bazillions and bazillions of entries is distributed across all this entire infrastructure that's been running since the early 80s to be able to resolve names. And the idea is that you go off and you buy a name and you reserve it and it happens to be hosted on a DNS server and then you can be found. Pretty simple stuff, right? Now, hierarchically, in case you're graphically inclined, like myself, I'm more visual, you got the root at the top, you got your top-level domains, TLDs, and then you've got your second-level domains. In this case, you got Manasseh, you got Microsoft, you got DOJ.gov, you got TechEd.au, whatever it happens to be. And then you've got one more level down. Normally, you control that area, but here's my first question to you all. What's that next level down called? Top level domain? Second level domain? Anybody? Come on. Third level domain? That's logical. Anyone else? Pardon me? Tertiary domains? Subdomains? Anyone hear subdomains before? How about, I like this one, child domains. That's more like Active Directory, right? Well, believe it or not, if you scan all the RFCs and look for a search for the word subdomain or child domain, it comes out as basically 45% say sub and 55% say child. So really, to me, that's moot point. You can call it either child domain or subdomain. It's all good for you, for whatever you want to call it. And it keeps on going down from there. So normally I'm going to be able to resolve stuff when I get down to that child-level domain or sub-level domain to be able to resolve things. That's called recursion, right? So here's my quick quiz for you. If I go right now and I set up a brand new server, Server 2008 R2, in a virtual machine using Hyper-V because it's fantastic, inside your network in your office, and you have a client that is configured to talk to that server, and you install DNS role on that server and do nothing else. If I query www.regularitguy.com, is it going to work? Show me your hands, say yes, it will work, out of the box, no extra configuration necessary. Anybody? Hands. You've got non-committal people here. You've only got not even 8 people. The other 95% of the room, you're saying it doesn't work? So put up your hands. You say it doesn't work? It's not going to work at all? Default install? Okay, so we have 5% of the room says will work, 35% of the room says doesn't work, everyone else, I want to know what's on the lunch menu. The answer, in case you're wondering, is it does work. The idea is that PC1 is going to go off and find my local DNS server, knows where it is. That local DNS server is going to go in and do its query, and it's going to say, I'm looking for, in this case, bigfirm.com. And then that particular DNS server is going to say, I'm going to go right to the top to root. And why is that? It's because DNS servers, at least in the Microsoft world, have a default install of knowing where the 13 root servers are. And then it knows the IP address, and it can go off and query those guys and start the recursion process. Make sense? Good. Now, we'll talk about 13, because 13 is actually a misnomer, but we'll get there in just a minute. So with that recursion, the root servers basically say, hey, I got no time to answer your question, because I've got about 100 bazillion other people asking me questions about this, because every single other DNS server in the world walks the root and then comes down, right? So it says, I'm too busy. Don't talk to me. I can't handle it. You're looking for a .com? Go talk to this guy over here. And here's a .com server. DNS says, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and ask the .com server, what is bigfirm.com's address, please? And this time, that particular .com server says, you know what? I'm way too busy, too. So I'm going to pass that off again, specifically to the guy or the gal or the server that happens to say, here's the one that's registered as authoritative or knows the answer for bigserver.com, or sorry, bigfirm.com's addresses and all subs beneath that. Go talk to him. Great. So DNS5 now goes off and asks bigfirm.com's DNS servers where to find that name server. It gets that address. It responds back and asks that guy directly. In this case, it's web2.manasseh.com. And says, hey, I'm looking for a.bigfirm.com, please. And this guy says, oh, well, I've got that on my hard disk. I can answer that question. Here you go. The address is 123.126.450, whatever it happens to be. And I'm in. I'm good. I now have my answer. And now DNS goes and gives it back to the client and says, here is the IP address. Go ahead and make your connection. And the client goes ahead and whatever application you were using, let's say it's a web browser, connection on port 80 to that address, boom, got the web page. We're all done. All that to resolve that one name by one client and it took less than a second or two across a massively distributed database to be able to resolve. It's a beautiful thing. I love infrastructure. It's beautiful. So the whole idea is that basically the root server and the .com servers basically know where to find everybody and where they have to be, and they're able to be in contact with each other, and they got resiliency in case the things happen to go down. DNS is basically going to keep on searching and searching and searching until it finds the person that has the authoritative answer by having that address inside the local machine on a local hard drive. Or it's going to take a cached entry from somebody else. And then the DNS is basically going to be authoritative for bigfoot.com, gives the address, and there we go. So if we review, how many was that? Did you guys count? Someone said four. Sorry. Someone said six. Well, let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Eight queries. All on what port? Anybody? Port 53. All on port 53, coming back to the client to resolve that one address. Eight queries going back and forth on the network. Multiply that by the hundreds of gazillions of thousands of systems that are using the internet to resolve names, and it's just, again, a mind-boggling thing. It's not quite as big as that prime number that we were talking about yesterday at the keynote, but still, pretty damn big. Still pretty impressive. So what's going on with these queries? Think of the number of queries that are going on and needs to be answered by individual DNS servers. How the heck do they track who asked what question and where to send the answers back to when it figures them out? Because, you know, it just says, I'm going to ask that question. I'll wait till someone comes back with me. Thank you very much. And so basically, what happens is the DNS server, when he asks the question to the other system, it says, hey, I'm attaching to you and asking you on port 53, but when you come back and talk to me, you can use whatever port you want, and here's the range I want you to use. So basically, in this case, let's say anywhere above 1024 and under 65355 transient port, basically. And it's different, sometimes incremental, sometimes random, it depends, to remember what that question was. And then to further give it some uniqueness, it assigns itself what's known as a TX ID or a transaction ID. And that's, again, another randomly number that's able to track inside its memory tables that, hey, I've got an outstanding question. And so when the answer comes back, it knows, okay, when I'm answering this guy, either, you know, shove off and go find somebody else, and here's some addresses to go talk to, or here's the answer, it's going to say, for that question you asked me, that I'm going to talk to you on this port, and then this transaction ID, and here's the answer I'm giving you. Like it or not, I'm done. Thank you very much. And then that server goes and processes that. Transaction IDs and transient ports, basically anything above 1024, is what gets used. And again, from a firewall perspective, because the question's going out on a known port and is not a random thing coming back in again, it's going to be allowed in and then be answered again. So it's all good. So graphically, we got DNS5 talking to WebMonastic2, saying, hey, I'm looking for this particular address, a.bigfoot.com. I've already walked this whole big tree to find out what the answer is. I want you to answer me with port number 3351 with a transaction ID of 279. And it goes off and continues to answer questions on the background as much as it can. Web2Manassi.com, basically, you're going to go in and respond back specifically on that port, 3351, with the transaction ID inside the packet of 279, and the answer is, among other things, the IP address 73.165.73.5. Nice and simple. Great way to keep track of all this stuff for the bazillions and gajillions of questions that are going on back and forth. When it gets its answer, it then responds back to the client, and off it goes. Now, the interesting thing about this as well, besides the scale and volume and tracking process, is the fact that DNS is one of those things that can actually go over port 43, obviously, but then choose to use different protocols. It can use TCP protocol or UDP protocol. That's interesting. TCP or UDP? UDP, by far, is the biggest preferential choice of what the servers are going to use, mainly because of the way it's formatted, the size of the packet, and just convention of the RFCs that's been happening since the 80s to say, hey, whenever I'm doing a traffic of a DNS query, port number 53 over UDP, it's nice and easy to go across the internet. You know, it goes across. It doesn't have to build up a session and take it down again like it does with TCP. It just simply goes off and asks and then comes back. It's nice and small. It doesn't get fragmented. It's nice and simple. basically heavily favoring UDP. But things can come back over TCP, potentially. And that's where things go wonky, is another troubleshooting thing I'll talk about in just a bit, is when things come back over TCP, it tends to look a little bit weird to some things, and therefore different actions get taken by clients and or by servers. So this thing that we talked about with 13, if you're ever doing packet analysis, again, it's not something I do as a pastime, but it is fun occasionally. I'll be doing one a little bit here. Whenever you're doing a query for DNS, you never see more than 13 systems coming back in that DNS response for looking for the next batch of servers. And this goes down to two very early RFCs, 883 and 1035, which basically said, hey, when you're doing TCP queries and you're using port 53 for this, the structure of the format of the packet looks like this. This is the question, this is the answer, and the answer, and the answer. It's going to be using UDP. Generally speaking, UDP packets are going to be 512 bytes in size. You can't fit a heck of a lot more than 13 fully qualified domain names and IP addresses inside more than 512 bytes, since that's why UDP packets of 512 is normally the standard for the maximum number of servers that you come out. But there's no freaking way the internet is being run by 13 only root servers out there. So what do you think they're doing in front of those servers to be able to answer those questions? We got some clustering going on. We got load balancing going on. It's pretty simple. It's only those 13 addresses, but there's like 200, 300 servers behind that one address to make it times 13 to give it the actual size. So interestingly enough, there's obviously a heck of a lot more root servers than just the 13 that are the IP addresses that come back. Now, some other issues that came up because of this, and this is where one of the big first troubleshooting things can come to you potentially, mostly for surfing for internet type traffic, is if I'm going to be doing any kind of older firewall rules or just generic rules, what some people have done in the past is some of the default rules and some of the vendors have simply come back and said, hey, if you ever see anything coming in that's claiming it's a DNS packet and it's fragmented, so basically larger than 512, it's been fragmented down, just drop it in the bit bucket and forget it, because it's probably something nefarious. We don't want to deal with it, and just ditch it. Never let it in. Shields up. If it claims it's a DNS packet, but it's actually not using TCP, but using, sorry, not using UDP, but using TCP because of size, again, drop in the bit bucket, forget it, just leave it alone. I don't want to see it. Drop it. I don't want to see it. Again, if it's a DNS UDP packet, but it's larger than 512 for some strange reason, and it would have to be fragmented, then again, drop it. Bad, bad stuff if you have these default rules that a lot of people still have inside their main firewalls. Because we'll see later why this is important, especially with some of the new things coming out with DNSSEC, with enhanced DNS and larger things going on with the world, things have changed. If I think back to the cell phone I had back in 1984, it's like, one of those big square things, rectangle, big antenna, stiff on the top, you're talking on it. I didn't have the StarTech yet, that was later, that was in the 90s, the big triangular flip phone. Things have changed significantly. We have, fridges with internet addresses. We have toasters with internet addresses out there, phones all over the place. It's just got to change. Things have evolved. So one example of this as an example, this happened about 2 years ago. You may have heard about this. But basically, let's say this one company, bigfirm.com, had a particular online business relationship with Yahoo. Yahoo, about 2 years ago, year and a half ago, basically, all of a sudden, on Tuesday, fell off the earth. They couldn't be resolved for anything at yahoo.com, for any kind of connection, e-commerce site, or anything at all. And it just stopped working on Tuesday. When you talk to the DNS administrators, they flush the cache, they bounce the services, nothing's working. It's just still, it's going out and then never coming back in again. What happened on Tuesday? Anybody? Firewall rule change? No. Actually, Yahoo published a 14th name server in their public DNS, and that replicated across the world. And basically, anyone that had the default firewall rules of anything larger than 512 coming over TCP or fragmented automatically dropped in the bit bucket. And that kills everything .yahoo.com. Doesn't matter what. Everything's dead. because when you're walking the line and going down the list of where things are, you have to be able to get a full list of name servers that are authoritative for Yahoo.com. And it was too big and basically didn't work. So here you go, published it. Anything Yahoo.com didn't work. Basically it came back at TCP because it was too large. Then a UDP packet of 512 basically was dropped at the firewall. And you know, other things have happened to have done this as well. So be very careful. If you haven't, if you're in charge of the firewall, check to see if you have these rules and possibly look at replacing them or outdating them. Yes, sir, in the black t-shirt, but I'm a PC. Okay, to repeat the question, basically he's asking, how does this work with IPv6? And because obviously it's going to be larger than 512 where things are going, right? How does it handle this? The answer is to be continued later on. Thank you very much for teeing me up, but you teed me up a little too soon for that question. So hang on to that one. So, magic troubleshooting key for all of this. We've done the brief history lesson. Really comes down to, oh, sorry, yes. Okay, so the question is basically a lot of the default firewall vendors don't go down to the level of looking at packet size is one of the things. So typically in that situation, what's going to happen is it's going to switch from 512 bytes over to TCP based, and there's normally a firewall rule that says any TCP port 53 traffic, nuke it, it's nothing that I want to see, or any transient port DNS traffic claiming that it's DNS that's larger and therefore TCP based, drop it. Those are the typical firewall rules that you'll see inside your environment. So hang on to that thought. We'll come back to that in a bit. It's not exactly it's looking for actual packet size. It's actually the format that the server answers in. Typically, it's going to be TCP when it's larger than 512. The best way to do this is to go through and to start doing some packet analysis. And that means that you're going to be looking at DNS queries and responses happening from your clients to your servers, all using Network Monitor as one example, or your own sniffing device, or Wireshark, or whatever it happens that you want to use. And already I've got one gentleman leaving the room. Hopefully it's not because it's Network Monitor. Oh, he's going to get a drink. Okay, good. So it's not that bad. It's very easy, light stuff that we're talking about. We're not talking encrypted packets and hashing algorithms and what's going on. We're just looking at some very, very basic structure for where things are going. So the setup basically is, and you can do this yourself. Again, very, very good. The reference that I'm going to be using as an example for this that I'll be seeing throughout here is a record called a.bigfirm.com. And I'm using that one on purpose because Mark Manassi, who actually created this session originally and I've modified it, he's actually registered a wonky record for name servers for a.bigfirm.com that is supposed to trigger this weirdness that happens inside your environment. So you can go back today, right now, and set up, as I mentioned, a server virtualized on Hyper-V because it's fantastic, using a Server 2008 R2 evaluation copy if you want to, you go and download it. Once it's up there, you install the DNS role. No other configuration required other than point a client to that particular system, and then load your network monitor on the server, and then hit capture, and then see what kind of conversation comes out of it. Pretty simple. Trick is you got to clean stuff up. And so with that, I'm going to take a look at the dreaded network monitor and just kind of show you a couple of things. So let me just clean up my windows before I bring it up here. Did I save that? I'm going to save that one there just in case. No, I did save it. So close him off. And then let's bring up network monitor and switch this guy over to my demo PC and take a look at it. So I'm keeping this pretty simple. This is a Windows 7 system. It's an x86 install. It's up and running. I happen to have it running in a virtual machine, obviously, as you can see. And I've plugged it into this live, beautiful internet pipe that you guys have here, which is super fast. And I've got Network Monitor installed. You can download this for free from Microsoft. Again, you can use whatever Network Monitor program you want to use. It's your call. And you can see this is the default look for what it looks like. Now, to speed things up and to keep things simple, a couple of recommendations that I got for you. The first is despite the fact that the gentleman over there in the red shirt was asking me about, was it red? No, sorry, black shirt, was asking me about IPv6. Let's keep this simple and start with baby steps. We're going IPv4, right? So you can see there in the bottom left-hand corner that I have a listing of all the different possible connections that I have coming out of my system. Some of them are the Treato Tunneling Protocol, some of them are IPv4, IPv6, and a bunch of other stuff. The best thing to do is turn everything off you don't need. So if I scroll over here, I can see this is the guy that I want. Everything else I want to turn off. There we go. Nice and simple. Next up, you should actually go ahead and turn off IPv6. Again, to clear things up. If you don't have the protocol loaded, you won't even see it in your network monitor, right? It's just gone. So clean that up. Now, the trick that you need to know is that to turn off IPv6, it's not simply a matter of just going in and turning off the ticky boxes inside the GUI interface to do that. It actually is a bit more in-depth to do, in case you didn't know this. So typically, you would think if I come over here and I say change my adapter settings, choose the properties, if I go in here and simply turn this guy off and turn off these other guys, that everything would be good. Well, it doesn't actually work that way. I can turn it off there. And then really, what I have to do is this guy. So I have this in the slides in just a minute here. You can see this. I'm going to have to make this a little smaller so it will fit with my zoom. There we go. So under HK Local Machine System Current Control Set Services TCP/IP6 parameters, you're going to want to basically go in here and put in disable components and then with a FF, which is 255. Once you've put that in, you reboot the box. It'll then basically turn off your IPv6 stack, turn it back on again, put a zero in there, reboot the box, and IPv6 comes back. That'll significantly reduce the noise on your network capture. Because of the interest in time, I don't want to actually go ahead and do that. I just thought I'd show you how to do it, and it's also documented in the slides in case you're interested. Now, next up, this is network monitor. Yeah, okay. So down here, I've gone in, and I've only enabled it on one NIC, and that's it. And then, you know, welcome to network monitor. Here's how it works. I want to go in here, and then also I'm going to turn on promiscuous mode. Promiscuous mode, in case you don't know, basically goes in and will go and look at other people's traffic besides my own if it's supported on that switch to be able to view more packet information. So I'll see responses coming back from my servers and other things like that. Now I'm live on that big network. So let's see what comes back out when I do a capture. I'm going to go ahead and simply say it's on. I'm going to say start. Go ahead and bring it to me, please. And let's go off and start finding out where my queries are. Oh, yeah, I got to do a query, right? So let's go and open up a command prompt here. And I'm going to say ping www.itsagreenhat.com. It's one of my podcasts that I do. It's going to go off and resolve it and come back, and everything's good. Okay, I'm going to say stop, and 912 packets in that short period of time were captured. Far too detailed to look at. The best thing I like about this guy, to keep it nice and simple, is it goes off and allows me to type in a parameter like DNS apply, and that's how simple it is to filter down 912 packets down to 4 that just happened on that network. And let's see what the 4 were. Now, because this is also tight for space, some other things. Because we're doing DNS stuff, it's small packets. You don't need to know hex data. Turn that off. You don't need to see these network conversations. Turn that off. Makes it much more useful to take a look at. There is my stuff. I can see. I can even go through and get rid of, you know, date time adjusted, time offset, process name, and stuff like that if I wanted to make it so I have more room. But I've got query for itsagreenhat.com, host address, class internet. I got a response. I then say, okay, well, I'm going to follow that up with a quadruple A, and then response as well. So pretty simple to very quickly clean up and look at a network capture. Again, do this in your site, try and troubleshooting with a healthy system first, isolated, capture and save that, and then go in and take a look at one when it's not working to see where those queries are going wrong. Anyone following so far? Good? No one's falling asleep? Good? Now, just to come back here for a moment. As I promised, some resources. There's the registry parameter you need to do to turn off IPv6 in case you're interested. There is also here, startup network monitor. That's what it looks like. Clear out that bottom left-hand area to make it so it's easier to see. And then also you can get rid of the network and the miscellaneous hex details as well to clean things up. And then do a ping or whatever you happen to do. Now, in case you haven't already done it because you're already doing this troubleshooting, again, make sure that you flush your local DNS cache for your client system. I knew that I hadn't queried for itsagreenhat.com, so I knew the thing would work. Otherwise, you're not going to capture anything. And then also get rid of the other columns you don't want, and then you go. I really like the concept of doing the filtering. And if you needed to in more advanced troubleshooting, you can obviously go through and filter by source and destination aliases, like computer names and IP addresses, so that you're only looking at the traffic between two things. Very, very handy when you're doing advanced stuff with doing dynamic registration, troubleshooting, and stuff like that. Now, with the NetMon stuff, the DNS-only traffic, as I mentioned, is as simple as going through and typing in DNS in the filter and clicking on Apply, and it's very good. And so you only see those responses, and it's good. And basically now we're caught back up again. And before we continue on, let's go back to that root server as an example. That root server really, again, wasn't one of just 13 addresses that's out there. It's 13 addresses that are listed. It actually gets much larger. There's actually, in this case in April, and I just went back and checked just in last week. If you go to rootservers.org, just for fun, since I have time, let me show you this site, rootservers.org. When it comes up, and I'll switch over. Rootservers.org. So, rootservers.org, it's a beautifully UX designed site. Plain text. And there are all of my root servers, in case you're wondering, that happen to be there, that are listed off. And as you can see, Australia's got 1, 2, 3, 4 different root servers that are out there, which is rather neat. You actually can see who's running them, who owns them, what their addresses are, and that sort of stuff. And then at the very, very bottom, you see down here, it says there are 254 servers that are root servers, roles behind those 13 addresses that are asking those questions. It used to be 268. What happened not too long ago that would have knocked 20-odd root servers off the map? Anyone guess? Pardon me? Japan tsunami basically knocked out about 12 or 20-odd root servers or so. Some of them are slowly starting to come back online again, but there's still a lot that are still off. So again, natural disasters can still have an effect overall, but doesn't take down the system because of the large disparity or large distributed nature of how things work. So kind of cool tidbit in case you're interested, like I am, on geeky stuff like root servers and how many there are, for where the root servers happen to be. So drilling down further, you got the issue of resolving a particular name, and you got the request going off basically from me to my server off to the root, and then coming back, and then a request goes off to .com, and then comes back, and then a request goes off to the DNS server responsible for bigfirm.com, and then comes back, and then off we go. Not too bad. Now, the packet is broken down into different areas inside the information for what's displayed. It's known as basically the Q and the three A's, or the question section, the answer section that contains the answer, obviously, the authority section for who's authoritative for it. Now, the funny thing is that Microsoft, with our network monitor, don't call it the authority section. We actually call it the name server section. That's just us. And then finally, the additional section that has extra information inside of it. And to take a look at this, because you can see it nice and big on the screen, as opposed to me showing you here on the capture, you can see the question count of 1, and then the answer count 000 that comes out. And so really, that's the one question and no answer. So that's the outbound question from my DNS server off to the other guys to say, hey, where is the stuff, please? And then down below, you can see that I'm looking for the record of bigfirm.com, or a.bigfirm.com. It's an IPv4 address, please, and off we go. You have to have pieces. You always have to have 4 pieces to your properly structured packet, and it can contain, you know, 1 or none or all 4 of these different pieces of information filled out. Pretty simple. Now, the response that comes back is rather interesting because it's much larger. So this is the first response that comes back, and it's talking to me about how the response comes back. Let's see what we can see here. It says the length at the very top, it says 502, So it's under 512. We know it's coming in on UDP. It's not TCP. And then it goes off and it lists the question that comes. It's sort of like, you know, when you're a parent, you answer the question with another question to your child. Same thing with DNS. You answer back with a question that basically says, okay, I've got 13 name servers for you, and then an additional thing as well on the 14th. And for bigfirm.com, go off and talk to some .com servers. And so there your global top-level domain servers.net, all the answers and all the addresses. So at least it says, I don't know, I'm too busy. Go talk to these guys. And by the way, here's all their names. Here's all their addresses. Go talk to them. I'm too busy. So great. Now, DNS is going to go ahead and basically make the exact same query to bigfirm.com, but this time .com server, and it's going to come back again with some the same format of a queue and three A's, basically. It's going to have one queue, no A's, basically. So where's my question? And then the response is going to come back with one queue and then two authorities. Basically, here's the authoritative DNS server for your system. And here you can see what it looks like. I don't have the answer, but go ahead and talk to this guy. He says he's authoritative, and then here are the answer for what it happens to be. And you can see there at the very bottom of that packet, the bigfirm.com name server is netdoor.manasseh.com, web2.manasseh.com, and then the addresses for both of those two systems. Great. Now, the system knows where to find the DNS server. It then goes the response. It knows the original DNS query was now properly resolved. It then goes in and basically looking at netmon, saying, okay, this is the proper format, this is what I'm supposed to see, this is the port sizes, these are types of questions. Now let's go off and try to troubleshoot why this thing isn't working for being able to respond to it. So let's take this back a step, because you guys have been very generous in giving me your time to go through the baby steps of how this works. And then now take a look at it from the perspective of, okay, how does this work with Active Directory? Active Directory has the ability to go off and to be also a DNS server. I usually put, from an infrastructure perspective, my DNS services on top of my Active Directory services at the same time. And it means that my client's able to go off and find DNS and say, hey, I'm looking for an Active Directory server. Okay, here's the services you're looking for. Here's the IP address. Go talk to him. Oh, by the way, it's me. And here's the answer. I now go ahead and do my Active Directory query. Now think about that from a client perspective. Okay, I found my DNS server. I found my Active Directory. I'm now going to go off and start to log on. And now once I'm done with my authentication process, because I'm a domain member, I'm now going to go in and start to dynamically register in DNS my system in case I need to be accessed by group policy, in case I need to be accessed by an application, or whatever. Same thing with a server, right? Now, when DNS fails, or dynamic DNS fails, it's going to go through the exact same process of what you just saw with the very simple internet query that goes on. The difference being is you don't walk the route. Your server, your clients, basically, are going to go in and ask DNS, I'm looking for this. It's going to say, oh, well, hey, I'm authoritative for this, so here you go. Here's the answer. Basically, Microsoft's a multi-master in Active Directory integrated DNS is multi-master. Every single server basically is sharing authority for those records, for those zones. It can answer the questions related to Active Directory. Anything else, it falls back on cache, or it falls back on a forwarder, or it uses traditional forwarding off to the root and then doing the stuff back and forth. Nice and simple. Now, with dynamic DNS, it would literally take about, and I've done this before, it'd take about a half an hour to go through every single one of the packets involved for a logon process from a client system into a server system, and then breaking down, you know, encryption connections, breaking down session connections, authentication requests, and everything else like that. So I'm not going to break it down in here, but the principles are basically the same. You would go off and do a query for the start of authority record for the domain that you're trying to log into. The query goes local DNS server. The response comes back. Does not bother going to .coms or top-level domains. It then goes back with the name of a primary DNS server. Now, the neat thing is it's actually going to come back and be give you the option of talking to one of a number of different published DNS systems that are inside your environment. And then the query is going to say, okay, I'm looking for this DNS server. I need to go off and register with the response. Those are still going to be queries, still on port 53 to initiate those ones out to that system. And then off you go with the success or failure. The biggest cause for dynamic DNS to fail is because a client has gone in and hard-coded an address to a non-Active Directory server, or has VPN'd in, and the ISP host has done some weird wonky stuff with the DNS server, or they're capturing packets to make it so that they can't do it. Generally speaking, it's a DNS-related issue and its configuration on the client side for why dynamic DNS fails.
or breaks. Or it's an authentication issue, where basically the computer account or the user account basically has an expired password, and it can't establish a secure connection with the server, and therefore you'll see those access denied messages coming back inside your system. Those are the two biggest things. Any questions I guess I should ask before going there? Good. I don't think if you don't ask any questions, you get out sooner, eh? You're not going to beat the lunch lines. So, been around since 84, DNS. Now it's getting a little bit long in the tooth for being able to work. We need to go off and do things called extensions to DNS. And this is where a lot of people have potentially gone ahead and said, ah, man, Microsoft just screwed this up. They're not doing it right with the way that they're doing extensions to DNS. Because it breaks, it doesn't work when I'm doing these big, larger queries coming across, and that actually isn't true for what's going on. So let me explain this to you. The extension of DNS, or extended DNS, basically says, hey, IPv6 addressing, DNSSEC addressing, these packets of 512 ain't going to cut it anymore. We've got to fix this and make this so it works without breaking the bazillion, gajillion queries that go on right now with the existing DNS infrastructure. So how are we going to do this? 99 basically came up with an RFC of 2671 called Extension Mechanisms for DNS, or eDNS. And in case you didn't know, eDNS has been supported in Microsoft DNS servers since 2003 when it came out. And it basically allows for some very interesting ways of identifying that it is an eDNS server. It can handle bigger queries and responses. However, those pesky firewall rules were breaking things out. So the whole goal with eDNS basically comes down to we have to leave the existing DNS as it is. We can't make any changes to those existing queries because that's 260-odd servers we've got to replace at the top level, plus then all the .coms and everything else. So basically, there are some goals basically with eDNS where it also resolves space issues for what you can do inside those packets. It gets rid of the limit of 512 bytes that's really kind of too small these days for what goes on. Lets other eDNS servers be aware that you're an eDNS server as well with how it does that. So basically, it negotiates a larger packet size. Basically, an extended DNS server that is aware is going to go off and tell other DNS servers whenever it makes a query, by the way, it's going to do a traditional method, ask the question, port 53, make the question, but it's going to throw in an OPT, or an optional bit, in there. And then part of that optional bit is going to say size for how big I can handle it, please, for any responses coming back. Now, the neat thing is traditional DNSs will simply say, I don't know what that is. I'll just give you the answer for what you're asking for using the traditional method. But an enhanced DNS will say, oh, this guy's talking eDNS to me. Fantastic. I'm going to go back and respond because he says he can handle 4,000 bytes, not 512. So great. That's how eDNS basically handles that additional conversation without breaking the regular DNS chain. So in this case, as I mentioned, a.bigfirm.com actually is a whacked out DNS domain that you can query that actually has 55 name servers inside of it with IP addresses. That definitely does not fit in 512 bytes. That's actually about 804 bytes or so. So it's definitely much larger. And then, in this case, here's an example of what that netmon trace looks like for that response. The query goes out saying, hey, I'm looking for this particular server, please, that has the OPT section in it. And it says, I'm looking for a.bigfirm.com, and I'm looking for that question. And I've got down at the bottom there, under additional resource record, OPT, sender's size limit is 4,000. That's the query. That will be rejected by every other regular DNS system. But an enhanced DNS or extended DNS will say, oh, cool, I can give them the big answer. And the response that comes back is actually kind of cool. The response that comes back, notice that it is UDP-based. You can see up there at the top, IPv4, UDP, source port 53, destination port, and here's my transaction IDs and everything, 850. So the response back says, okay, cool. You said that you support 4,000. Well, here's the answer over UDP. It's 850. What's going to happen if you have the default potential old-fashioned firewall rules with this packet? It's going to drop. If you have those default rules, or potentially if you have those older rules that are still in place, it's going to drop this. And that's where people came back and said, ah, Microsoft screwed up their implementation of extended DNS or enhanced DNS. And it's not working for me. I can't do name resolutions anymore. In actual fact, it was the firewall issue that's out there we're still following the proper RFCs, and we have since 2003. So on top of that, it comes back and basically says, hey, the response on the EDNS system, you can actually see a list. That's actually only the last 5 records out of the 55 records of all the name servers that answer to that, in case you want to try that at yourself. You can see that the largest on this, on the receiving side that's going to come back with the answer is not 4,000, it's 1280. You can see that there with payload size, also with the OPT record, in case we need to have more continual conversations. This becomes extremely important for IPv6. This becomes extremely important for DNSSEC as well, because you can't fit that type of security information inside a small 512-byte packet. Good? So comparing with non-EDNS, you've seen this. Basically, it's going to go in and respond back. Now, in this case as well, it's going to respond back. Notice the protocol change. It switched it up. It's now using IPv4 still, but it's going to TCP with fragmentation, possibly, to be able to get this data across the internet to you back. And again, this also might be prone to be trapped by those firewall rules as well and disappear. So the EDNS server goes ahead and negotiates, larger than 512. It goes and it runs into one of those routers that has a bad firewall rule. It dies somewhere on the route someplace, because there's routers in the internet that also have firewall rules as well. And basically, things just stop working. And again, IPv6, it's coming. So people have got to go through and fix it up. One workaround you can do, which I do not recommend. I'll take a question in just 1 second. One workaround that I don't recommend is that you can actually go in and turn off EDNS probes, basically, enabled DNS probes on your DNS server with a 0, and that's basically a band-aid fix. Don't do it, because you will forget you put it in there, and then when you need to use EDNS, you'll forget, and it's not working, and then you'll call me up back in Canada, and I'll say turn off the flag, and everything will work again for you. Be aware of that to basically set that thing. I say don't do it. Instead, fix your damn firewall rules, and then we'll go from there. Yes, sir, in the black shirt behind the guy with the blue shirt. The question is basically, is it any better to go ahead and to change the port from port 53 to something else as another option for EDNS to make it work? And unfortunately, I would say no, because you would basically break the gazillion and kajillion queries that are going on. You'd have to redo your entire top level 13 infrastructure from the top level down and build it all over again going back to 1984. So, don't do that. It's much easier. This is actually a very unique way. It's not just Microsoft that does this. Other EDNS servers as well. Bind will go off and do this as well, where it simply goes in and says, hey, here's the optional flag. Here's how big I can handle it. Thank you coming back. We'll start talking on EDNS from now on. Everything's all good. It's really a firewall rule you got to fix. It's not a temporary solution you got to worry about. Doing a time check here. I'm up to about an hour. I got 50 minutes left, which is all good. So why bother? As you saw, March 31st basically is when they finished signing off the .com domain from a security perspective, from certificates. You can now start doing DNSSEC stuff. The soft limitation is really kind of silly these days, and you have more space. So the tools. I've been talking about infrastructure and how this all works for so long. What are the tools that we can look at? And first off, that comes to mind whenever you say DNS troubleshooting to anybody is, oh, let's go NS lookup. NS lookup is your entry level. Does my name resolving work? And then that's really about it. It's not very good at all. Much better is a tool that's called DIG, or Domain Internet Groper, that you can download. It's a free tool. It's an open source tool. Be able to go and download. isc.org/downloads has a Windows version of Bind. You can then go and download that 8 meg file, I think it is, extract it, and then Mark's saying you can actually go through here and simply copy the DLLs over and then simply run them side by side. Just be aware that will only work if you're running a 32-bit operating system. If you're running a 64-bit operating system, you cannot do this trick of simply just taking the DLLs and executable file and using it. You actually have to do the install. To do the install, there is a ticky box that says tools only. And then you put it inside a directory structure, you change in that directory structure, and then you run DIG. Now, the neat thing about DIG is, actually, first of all, has anyone ever heard of DIG before? There's a good number of people here. Good. Awesome. For those that have not heard of DIG, very quickly, DIG is basically a client way of doing server type queries to pretend, you know, let's pretend I'm a server doing these queries. So when you respond to me, I can see what they all are, right? So in this case, you've got a DIG for a name, like regularitdata.com, for a record type, and then options and options to see what it comes back as. Some examples using manassi.com, look for the MX record. Don't bother doing any recursiveness, please. Just go ahead and tell me what you got. Going ahead and doing a trace, which is really cool to basically show me every single step of the way. I use the trace option a lot when I'm doing some troubleshooting on stuff. Very, very nice to see the output on it. And then obviously you can get the /h for what it looks like. Some other switches you can take a look at, force TCP, force UDP to test stuff, DNS set queries, also very good as well. But this is basically what it looks like from a response from where we are. And open up the command prompt. At the command prompt, you basically just type in dig.exe, put in the queries that you want to do, and comes back. And notice here, we've got the question section, we've got answer section, authority section, and additional section nicely laid out for you as if it was a packet scan. And that would be repeated for every single recursive query that would have to take place to resolve that name. Very, very nice to look at. You see all the responses there. And the best part is, it's not network monitor. It's nicer to look at. So DIG is your friend for sure. Netmon for the exact same frame, basically. Again, I showed you Netmon already for what that basically looks like. Now, some other stuff with DIG is the status that you'll see here under the header. And the status is basically is, you know, no error means it worked successfully. NX domain means no such record. So basically the query failed. There was no answer for that one correctly. Server failed means basically, hey, this guy's not coming back to me. It's giving me a weird error message. And then no IMP or so it was not implemented, which means it doesn't implement or doesn't work with maybe a TCP response. It also refused to say you're rejected. So some great stuff in there from where that works. Another tool that is specific to, in this case, Active Directory troubleshooting for the most part, Tim Rines at Microsoft basically wrote this tool. And you can download it as part of the resource kit and use it. DNS Lint is what it's called. Now, the neat thing about DNS Lint basically is it's going to be doing a lot of stuff with the health of your DNS system. It also will give you replication information if it's Active Directory based, and also give you information as well about server records, make sure they're all registered correctly inside your server records, and everything's all good. And I like it because it gives me a nice HTML formatted response that I can look at. It also color codes the green for good, yellow for warnings, and reds to mean you got some really serious stuff going on. I always run this when I'm doing DNS migrations and when I'm also running Active Directory migrades and upgrades, migrations and upgrades on my systems. KB article 23.1.045 has a download link to this guy here. You can go off and install it, and you're good to go. Now, DC Diag has been around since 2001. It's also extremely good. However, you must have administrative rights to be able to run this guy against your Active Directory and your DNS servers, and it can be intensive on the network because it's going to be doing RPC calls, not just standard small little UDP packets up to your servers. So RPC calls are going to take place. If you're running a big national DNS system for Active Directory for all the different provinces here in Australia, and you're talking like, you know, 50 or 60 DNS domain controllers that are out there, don't run the /e-switch. Because it's going to go off and basically try to talk and establish an RPC connection to every single one of your DNS and domain controllers to do these queries and tests to come back with a response. And it's going to do it immediately. So it's basically like this big flood of stuff going across. This one's more of an after-hours stuff to do to be able to go off and talk with this guy. So DC Diag, also very good, specifically more so about the health, not about the queries. All these things are really about the health of how your DNS system is running right now inside your Active Directory. DC Diag as well has some very simple things for DNS tests, go off and give me verbose, does a ping, checks access to forwarders, makes a dynamic entry, sees if it's working or replicated, checks for different server records, and if you're running with IPv6, again, it can also throw some weird errors, so be aware of that. Kind of cool for where DC Diag goes. Now, besides that, and I'm going to open this up to a little bit of questions as well, this session was originally created by Mark Manassi, and he has delivered it in TechEd North America, and he's obviously got a whole bunch of different articles. But you have everything you need to start your DNS troubleshooting now by simply understanding the concept of how does a recursion work, What are the types of questions I should be seeing and the answers I should be seeing? What ports is it going across? And then what's a healthy system look like? Because once you have that, you can then take a look at it from an unhealthy system and resolve that back with a contrast between the two of them. You can save your captures. You can set up a lab and have it up and running in less than half an hour very, very quickly. And all these tools are very quick in download. And trust me, if you download them on this pipe, you'll be downloading in a matter of seconds because of how fast they are for where they go. So I strongly suggest you go off and try some of these tools. If about 60% of the room raised their hand and said that they've used Dig before. I've completely replaced my NSLookup with Dig entirely with the way that I do my troubleshooting with my client systems. It's a little bit overkill when I'm trying to help out my mother-in-law in Charlottetown, New Brunswick, or Charlottetown PEI, but you know it works to be able to troubleshoot stuff from where that sits. And the one example that we had for dynamic DNS registration, the biggest issue you're going to have to worry about is hard-coded DNS addresses going the wrong way, pointing to non-dynamic DNS systems, either by your ISPs or by elsewhere. The hilarious thing is that when you call up tech support and you know more about, I'm willing to bet everybody in this room probably knows more about DNS now after the session to be able to help out whenever your ISP happens to have a DNS issue, you'll be able to fully explain that, oh, well, I used Dig and I did this and this and this and this and this and this, and here's the response, and you got a problem with this, and you got to change your firewall rules. You'll be sending the tech support person spinning, not understanding what it is you're talking about with being able to troubleshoot some stuff. And with that, and with my time allotment that I happen to have, I've got a lovely 7 minutes left for questions before you go off and have some lunch. Before you do that, however, I have a favor to ask. And that quaver is Q&A. Fill out your evals. I've had a blast coming down to Australia and also to New Zealand. Part of that reason was because I got some nice evals. I would love it if you could tell me what I could do better to make this session better, what I could do to make this more entertaining for you and more informative for you. And please fill out your evals. There's prizes to be won every day. I'm going to take some questions, but thank you very much. It's been awesome. Thanks. So you don't have to all jump up and run away. I'm more than willing to take questions, try some stuff out, whatever you like. We've got about 7 minutes before the lunch queues start to build. Everyone is running away. Don't forget your evals, please, everybody. Evals are important. And for those of you that are staying, any questions about DNS you'd like to come down and ask, or you're just out of bed? Yes, sir. Got to speak up nice and loud so I can hear you. I'll repeat them. Are any other classes of records or DNS servers or? Yeah. Okay. So the question basically is, hey, when you're doing other types of queries, not just the query you get for the A record or the CNAME record, whatever it is, does all this stuff still work and still apply? And the answer is basically, yes, it does. It's all the same concept. The question up here was, when there going to be some PowerShell integration for DNS, and when's that coming? I can't answer that question for you, but I'm sure that they are not too far off in the near future because everything is going down the PowerShell commandlet way, and so sit tight. We'll see where you should be. Yes?
What's happening with DNS security? Is that root-level stuff that's changing?
What's going on with root-level stuff with DNSSEC and DNS security? When's that going to start changing? And it comes down to, eventually, it's got to be phased in. First, we've got to solve the issue of having DNS servers understand eDNS for the sizes of stuff. Currently, DNSSEC stuff is going to be happening with specific domains between different systems. And that's it. So it'll come soon. It's taken a long time to even just get the .com top-level domain signed. And that's only one domain. We've got to sign the rest of them too, right? So that's more to come.
Mm-hmm. They're not registering a new IP address for that VPN. What are the best ways to ensure that? Is that possible? And also, the other problem is, if you're using dynamic DNS, a machine gets rebuilt.
Yeah.
If it's using secure dynamic DNS, it doesn't automatically update the old record anymore.
Yeah. Okay, so basically some questions around VPN connectivity for clients. registering dynamic DNS inside their servers, ways to get around that, ways to solve that. Unfortunately, there's no good answer to that one because there's too many things. The answer to that one, believe it or not, is actually, and I'm a huge believer in this, direct access. Because direct access is really kind of cool. I didn't get a chance to talk about that here, but direct access, what it does is basically the IP stack initializes, and before it goes off and tries to establish secure tunnels back to my UAG server or my direct access server, I go off and do a DNS query to an unreachable address that's only available inside my office. And then when it fails, it says, oh, I'm outside. I'm going to go ahead and start to establish my secure connections and see what I can walk through the most secure, least secure, least secure, least secure, least secure method that's allowed with my policy for dynamic DNS, or for direct access. But once it's gone ahead and established that, then it says, oh, I can now reach my internal DNS servers. I can now go ahead and make my DNS queries to my internal DNS servers. And I can now go ahead and start to do dynamic registrations like I should be as they all go. So that's generally the way it's going to fix it. It's not going to fix it with a short-term gap of fixing your VPN connectivity software, unfortunately, because there's too many variables with who's in between where that sits. So with IPv6, with IPsec between your systems, with direct access becoming more and more ubiquitous, this sort of stuff starts to go away. Start. And it's not just Microsoft stuff, too. It's other stuff, too. Good. Thanks, everybody. The evals are all online. You go back to the online sign in with the computer, and you can go off into your eval. It takes 5 seconds. 5 is good, 1 is bad.